This is Space Kate, and I am in Cornwall, and I have come to the Goonhilly Earth Station, and I'm currently on a rooftop underneath an absolutely ginormous dish. And with me is Matthew Cosby, and he is a director here at Goonhilly, and also a chief scientist, very smart. So tell us, what is this gigantic monumental dish for?
So this is a 32-metre diameter antenna. It was originally designed in sort of the late 70s, built in the early 80s for communicating with geostationary satellites. When the satellites were very low power, they had very poor receivers and poor transmitters, so having the large apertures on the ground were needed to communicate to the spacecraft. Since then, the spacecraft have got better and more powerful, so the need for large dishes have been reduced, and so we have smaller apertures. So this antenna is ideally suited for deep space further away, the Moon, Mars, those sort of missions, those sort of spacecraft.
So is that what you're using it for? Are you talking to, well, is there anything on the Moon at the moment that you're talking to?
No, we're planning on converting the antenna from commercial frequencies into deep space frequencies, so S and X band, to support the future missions. But we believe there's a market for commercial exploration, such as for mining and looking on the surface of the Moon, and also going to Mars. And we think that private enterprise will take over a lot of the deep space communications for those commercial missions.
Well, you've got not just one enormous dish here, but I can see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Actually, I'm not even going to count them all. There's so many. How many have you got?
We have about 25 antennas. Three of them are the large variety, ranging from 27 metres to 32 metres, which one we're standing underneath. The large three antennas we use for radio science and deep space, but all the other smaller antennas, ranging from 7 metres to 16 metres, are used for commercial geostationary communications, which what this, the large dish that we're standing underneath was designed to do originally.
And you've got quite a famous dish here. I mean, in as far as dishes can be famous, it was, didn't you, you picked up the first live television signals from America?
Yeah, so in 1962, Telstar was broadcasting the first transatlantic video, and Arthur, as it's known, was built in 1962 specifically for that mission. And there were competing receiving stations across the continent. There's one in France and obviously one in the UK, and they were different technologies. The UK went for the parabolic antennas, the Europeans went for a horn based antenna, and the parabolic one, as you can see, is the one that won out, because we no longer use the horns.
Is this like a VHS Betamax kind of thing?
Sort of, yeah. It was competing technologies of those sort of lines, yes. But the it's easier to point for the parabolic, and it's got a greater uses and so on.
Now, you mentioned earlier that you've got a hitchhiker's reference here. Now, is that because your dish is called Arthur Dent, by any chance?
Though the reference to hitchhikers is that when the Vogons came, we failed to notice them. And apparently, according to Douglas Adams, our role in that was to look out for alien invaders, which was never our role. So although we're very happy for Douglas Adams for having references to both Jodrell Bank and ourselves, we were probably wrongly credited. But we are a great fan of the Hitchhiker's Guide, and one of the control centres here will be named after Douglas Adams going forward.
And in future, will you use any of these dishes for looking for any alien signals?
I think the only alien signals we'll be looking for are from stars, radio science, where we plan to be part of the E-Merlin network with Jodrell Bank and Cambridge. So whether those will ever spot alien life is unlikely, but the stars will be detected.
So the dish that picked up the first signal was called Arthur, and we were at Antenna 6. Has it got a more romantic name than just number 6?
So it's not named after Arthur Dent, but King Arthur. So a lot of the legend, all the antennas are given legend names, and the one we're standing under is Merlin. So yes, and we can just see over as the sun setting to Guinevere.
Now, it seems to have vanished under the... Oh, no, there it is. I can still see the moon from up here. And you're pointing this dish at the moon at the moment. Is it... Are you actually tracking the moon through the sky?
Yeah, we are. We want to do commercial operations for around the moon. And one of the first steps is to look at calibrating the dish and upgrading it and with the frequencies. And what we're doing at the moment is just tracking the moon. And we've got an opportunity to offer the dish while we're doing that to amateur radio enthusiasts who like to bounce signals off the moon and try and communicate across the world. So this morning we did a world record distance with Australia in Melbourne, Australia, and we went across from Japan to Russia and a few European contacts at lunchtime. And now, as the sun sets and the moon sets with it, we're talking to guys from the east coast of the US, and the final contact before we lose the moon will be on the west coast in San Diego.
So I know that you can bounce lasers off little mirrors that were put on the moon during the Apollo missions, and so you can work out the exact distance between Earth and the moon. Is that basically what you're doing? You've got something on the moon that you're bouncing your signals off?
No, we're bouncing it purely off the moon. So we're such a...
The whole moon, just the moon.
The whole moon, yeah. So the antenna is such a large antenna, so our beam width is very narrow. So we're actually illuminating only a quarter of the moon. So, and we believe we are illuminating probably the centre of the moon. And we're just using that, the whole heart centre of the moon, as a reflector. We believe about 11%, 10 to 11% of the power is reflected back. Rest of it is scattered. Because there's a different terrains, the signal will come back at different times, which is why you'll get a slight distortion on the signal. But we're not using anything specific, just the actual moon as itself as a reflector.
And the reason that you're able to pick up the reflection is because you've got this ginormous dish, or could you still pick up that signal even if you were, say, like an amateur radio person?
We are talking to amateur radio people with dishes ranging from 1.8 metres to 6 metres, 9 metres.
I can't be that amateur to have a 9-metre dish.
I think amateur is because it's they use it as a hobby, not because of they're not professional. And a lot of expertise lives within that community. So people do like to have large dishes in their gardens or have access to larger dishes. And not as large as the one we're standing underneath, but having a large aperture does help for the signal to be up there and we received the signal. The long distance we did with Australia, the fact that we had a large dish enables us to do that.
And I can hear a sort of whirring, buzzing kind of noise as I'm standing here in front of the base of this mighty beast of a dish. What's that?
The antenna is slowly tracking the moon, and it's a highly geared set of motors, and it's slowly creeping around the rail. It's sitting on a rail, like a railway line, locomotive rail, and it is slowly creeping around. If we have a look at the wheels, you'll just see them slowly, slowly moving. And because we're in the latter part of the day, the moon is beginning to set, the elevation is slowly creeping down as well, so you can... The whirring is just the motors going to keeping it on track of the moon.
And now the moon sort of vanished behind some clouds there. Does that affect the signal?
Not really. You will see a slight drop in the power, but it's not going to affect. The lower down you get to the horizon where you're going through more atmosphere, actually rain will affect the signal more than the clouds. If it's raining and we're going through rain, you do get rain fade. But because we're reasonably high up, I think we're still 30 degrees above the horizon, so we're not going through a large amount of atmosphere. In the morning when it rose, and when it'll setting in about an hour's time, when we're going about 2 degrees above the horizon, then we'll be going through a lot of atmosphere, and then we'll be getting a lot of distortion from our atmosphere, both going out and then coming back.
Well, I don't know about you, but I'm getting a little bit chilly up here, so maybe we can pop down and see what they're up to downstairs. Okay, right, we're out of the cold and into the warm. Oh, there are people huddling around. What's happening? What's your name, sir? Noel? Noel G8GTZ. Interesting surname. Cornish?
Yes. No. That's my amateur radio call time. My real name is Noel Matthews.
And what are you doing down here?
So we're here today, group of radio amateurs, using the dish, the big dishes at Goon Hilly, to bounce signals off the moon to talk to other radio amateurs around the world.
And it sounds a bit like... Can I go a bit closer? Is that okay? That sounds a bit like Morse code.
Very good. Yes, it is Morse code. We're actually working a guy in the States at the moment, stationed in the States, and we're using Morse code because actually it's the one reliable way of getting signals across when it's very weak or very poor conditions. So Morse code is still used for Earth-Moon-Earth communications.
Wow. And are they able to translate it as fast as they can tap to you?
Oh, yes. These guys are very skilled at doing Morse code, and some operators even can listen to Morse code and receive it and type it directly in on a keyboard.
That is quite a skill. The only thing I think I've seen that's matched anything like that was I was actually at Bletchley Park for one of the reunions, and there was a lady there. There was a bit of kind of ticker tape, and she was just rolling her thumb down it as if. And I said, "Are you actually reading that?" She said, "Oh yeah," she said. "I'm a little bit rusty, but yeah, still pick it up."
Yes, I heard one of the Bletchley Park operators was able to read Morse code and type it on the keyboard, but the difference was the Morse code was being sent in French, and they were typing English on the keyboard.
Well, that's pretty impressive. But I'm still more impressive to me right now is the fact that there's two chaps sitting here with a laptop and some radio equipment bouncing signals off the moon.
That's right. So this is a planned activity weekend that through Goon Hilly's great support. Currently, the big dish isn't being used, so they've invited us to come down as a special activity weekend. We've alerted other radio amateurs around the world who do Earth-Moon-Earth communications, and so we've had a great day of activity. We started off this morning when the moon was rising in our east, and we worked stations in Australia. And then as the moon rose, we worked Japan, Russia, Europe, and now as it's setting in the west, we're working stations in the Americas and Canada, and we've just recently contacted a station in San Diego right on the west coast of America.
That's pretty incredible to think. I mean, the moon is, what, a quarter of a million miles away? So if you're sending a signal up and back, that's 500,000 miles.
That's correct, yes.
That is a long-distance phone call.
It's a very long-distance phone call, and, you know, that just makes it a great technical challenge, which is why we're doing it. We know you could pick up a phone and talk to these guys, but actually, no, that's not what it's about. This is about the technical challenge of bouncing signals off the moon, which is a non-coherent reflector, i.e. it doesn't bounce signals very easily. They go all over the place. Half a million miles. There's a 2.5-second delay from when we transmit signals to them being received back at the Earth. So it's just a great technical challenge. And being able to do it here in this, what can only be called an iconic venue, is a fantastic opportunity for us.
So since you like a challenge and you're sending signals from Earth to the Moon and back again, But I know that on the International Space Station they also have amateur radio kit. So have you sent a signal from Earth to the Moon and back to space and talk to anyone on the ISS today?
No. But
next time.
Yes, maybe next time. But what we have done in the past, there is an amateur radio station, you're absolutely right, on the ISS, and we were part of the team that went around the 10 schools when Tim Peake was on the ISS, and we held conversations for the students to be able to talk directly to Tim Peake as part of their educational program.
That's quite an opportunity, is it? I never had anything like that when I was growing up. In fact, it wasn't until about 7 years ago and I met somebody from NASA that I realised, oh, wait, hang on, this space stuff is real and actual people work in it. It's not just in... You know, in the same way when I first went to see the Eiffel Tower or the first time I saw the Sydney Opera House, like, oh my gosh, like, I know all about this thing, but I never thought I would experience it myself.
Yeah.
But this, yeah. So, I mean, obviously you're in a very lucky position. You've got a 32-metre diameter dish up there. Not everybody's got one of those to play with. So can other people you know, are there other people around the world that can tune in and hear what you're doing at least?
So it has to be said that Earth, Moon, Earth, or EME as we call it, is probably the extreme of amateur radio. And there are probably 100 operators around the world who've got the equipment to be able to do it. It by the very nature of what you're doing, you have to have a dish in your back garden. The minimum size of dish that we've worked today is 2 meters, so a 6-foot dish, it's quite big. So your average radio amateur probably wouldn't be doing Earth, Moon, Earth. But on the other hand, you talk about the ISS. The ISS is 220 miles away, and people have been known to hear the ISS and even talk to the ISS just using a handy talkie out in their garden. So, you know, that's the great thing about amateur radio. It's so wide and so broad, and it's a technically challenging hobby. And I think that's why we all do it.
And how, like, if somebody was listening to us having this chat now and thinking, actually, that sounds really amazing, I want to play, where would they even begin? Like, is there a website, or is there, you know, a group? Is there somewhere that somebody could help them?
So the best place to go to, if you're in the UK, there is a society called the Radio Society of Great Britain, RSGB. So if you just Google RSGB, that's great, where they've got a great website. And dotted around the country, in almost every town, there are amateur radio clubs. And generally, if you go to them, they'll welcome you and take you on board and show you how to get started. To be able to transmit, you do actually have to take exams, but there's a novice license, an intermediate and an advanced license. So it's very easy to do that first step to get on. But beware, once you get involved, the bug bites, and it bites deep. And you find yourself on a Friday night at Goonhilly.
Well, frankly, I couldn't think of a place I would rather be right now. This is amazing. Thank you so much for sharing this with us. Thank you.
And thank you.